I'm Cynthia Schuster filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and it's my pleasure to welcome Alan Alda to the program. You might remember him best for his role as Hawkeye Pierce on the TV show MASH, or more recently as the host of the PBS series Scientific American Frontiers. You may have also read his memoir, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned, or maybe one of the countless other achievements under his belt. Well, this week he joins the Ten Chimneys Theater in Genesee Depot as their 2013 master teacher, and he's with us for the remainder of this hour. If you have any questions for Alan Alda, our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Alan Alda, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, thank you.
Well, you are in high demand. I want to know what appealed to you about the Ten Chimneys opportunity. You couldn't pass it up.
When I heard that there would be 10 actors here who were the top actors from theaters all around the country, the idea of working with them for a whole week really sounded intriguing to me and exciting. It's a chance to work with actors who are at the top of their game and see if we can come up together with ways of approaching our work, which I call an art and not a craft. It's common for actors to say their work is a craft. I think a craft is when you make a pot, but I think when you do acting, you're using your whole body and all of your experience and your brain, and it's possible for it to be an art, to be very creative, and that's what we're looking for here.
Well, it sounds like you had to be creative over dinner on, I believe it was Sunday night. Were you welcomed by a storm and a blackout?
Yeah, that was great. That was really nice. The people here had been planning that dinner for a long time, and I think they didn't like it that the storm knocked out the electricity. But I think all of us actors loved it because we had to improvise.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to find our way around the Ten Chimneys house with our iPhones providing the light. And it made it a very romantic and improvisational evening, which is good because the whole thing that we're doing here this week is to explore spontaneity through improvisation. So it was a perfect beginning.
Did you take the opportunity then to turn it into a formal lesson, or did you just enjoy your dinner?
No, what we did was we turned it into a chance for us to get to know one another. So mm-hmm. over candlelight and our iPhones, we got to know who we were, and we talked about our beginnings, where we were born, and that kind of thing. Because the basis, I think, of all good work together on the stage is to be able to know one another and accept one another. You really can't act with strangers very well. You have to get close and intimate with the other people. Otherwise, it looks like you're pretending. It looks like you're trying.
Is that how you've conducted yourself throughout your career? Have you taken a moment before getting started on a project to really get to know your fellow actors?
I have. When I first began, I didn't know how important it was. I didn't even think about it. I thought going on stage was something that you do. You go on stage, you do what you know how to do, you do what you figured out you would do, and you do it, and then everybody notices you. You know, the difference between that and really doing a play that works is you become a group, and everybody notices the electricity among the various players in the group, and that's something I've learned over the years, and that's made the whole process more interesting to me. And that's one of the things that we're developing here, and after just this is our second day, we're halfway through our second day of working together, and at the end of the first day you could see that there was cohesiveness among all of the people in the group, and everybody thought of themselves as part of that crowd and not just individuals worried about how they were doing, but thinking of themselves as part of this overall entity that was a much more appealing and safe place to be.
Mm-hmm. Ironically, once you get to know these people as individuals and as themselves, then you all get on the stage and pretend to be other people.
Well, you know, the thing about it is the less pretending you do, the better.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, it's an act of imagination. And if everybody is entering into that same act of imagination, you accept one another as these different characters that you're playing, and you get from one another what makes you do what you do. You don't say your lines because you memorized them. You say your lines because the other person has just made you say it. And that's the difference between a kind of dead, rote performance and one where you believe you're looking at something alive.
So how do you teach spontaneity?
Well, I do it through improvisation. The most interesting thing that I did as a young actor was to learn improv. And I learned what most people think of as improvisation is comedy mm-hmm. improvisation, where the whole point is to keep the audience laughing. This is more of a more pure kind of elemental work, which was invented by a woman called Viola Spolin decades ago, and it's called theater games. And you play these games in the same way that you'd play basketball. You play according to a strict set of rules, and if you follow the rules, you're not making up jokes. In fact, you say things that aren't really funny, but often the audience can't help but laugh at it because it's so spontaneous. It's so much an expression of what's in the unconscious suddenly making its way out to the surface, popping its head out, and it surprises you when that happens.
Mm-hmm. Do you find it's hard to teach spontaneity to actors? Is it hard for them to pull themselves away from the script?
No. Everybody, I think, feels freed by improvisation because, first of all, it's a game, so it's fun to play. And secondly, there's a lot of hilarity in the process because when you see people struggling to play these games, a flush comes to their faces that's born of real presence and real work. And so you're in the presence of something that's happening in a way that doesn't happen if people are saying memorized lines. And what's interesting about this is, I'm very interested in science. I did Scientific American mm-hmm. Frontiers on public television for 11 years. Have another show coming out in the fall called Brains on Trial about brain science and the justice system. So I'm very interested in science, and I, a few years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, I helped start the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University, and we teach scientists to communicate better. We teach them to write more in a more communicative way, but we start by teaching them improvisation. We teach the scientists improvisation, and you might think that they might be resistant because they're not used to going out on a limb and not speaking from the script when they're talking in public. They know they have to be very careful to be accurate when they talk about their work, and they must be. But it's possible to be accurate and spontaneous and personal at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essential if you're talking to lay people, because if you lecture them using formulas and jargon and concepts that they're unfamiliar with, you're really not going to communicate to them about your work. But what's wonderful is I've seen scientists grow from improvisation. I've seen musicians grow. I was at a music camp, and I worked with young musicians. They got better at speaking about music. They even got better about playing music, because there's this wonderful thing that happens through improvisation where you become more in touch with the people you're performing for, and more in touch with people you're performing with, and with your own inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
You're more awake to what's happening inside you.
Who do you think would provide a good example of someone who can communicate science effectively to a layperson?
Brian Greene is a wonderful example. Uh, he's uh, he's terrific speaking and writing. He's a you may know he's a physicist at Columbia University who writes best-selling books about string theory, which is very tough to communicate. And he does it in plain language with images that are comprehensible and fun to read. I think Richard Dawkins, who wrote The Selfish Gene, is a wonderful communicator in his books and in person, too. And as a matter of fact, we talked about that, and he said that he's experimenting more and more on the web using a conversational approach in other words, talking with other scientists in a conversation, which prevents them from making lectures and opens up the science to the people listening in a way that makes it available to them, because the conversational tone is so much more understandable than a lecture tone, or what usually is a lecture tone. The whole hope is if somebody gives a talk, they won't give what we think of as a lecture, but they'll have a conversation with you. The tone will be a conversational tone, you know.
And the language, I'm sure.
The language changes completely when the scientist talks to the audience as though they're really there and they really are fellow humans listening. The tone changes completely, and this happens among actors. And sometimes, you know, you'll see sometimes performances on television where they have to rush. The people don't even know each other. They get up and they play a love scene, or they play some scene of conflict, and you can see they've decided, now I say this line like this and now I say this line like that, but they're not really talking to each other. And when that's lacking, the audience isn't drawn in the same way.
I'm talking with Alan Alda, and we're talking about the importance of spontaneity, not just on stage, but in everyday life. And he highlighted some examples of why it's important even in the sciences. What questions do you have for Alan Alda? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Alan, we have a call from Joyce in Neenah. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Mr. Alda. How are you?
Hello, Joyce. Good. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to Wisconsin. We love doing MASH. And
thank you.
I'm just wondering, are you actors that are there going to put any kind of a theater on for the public while you're here?
There is Saturday night, a little evening where we're going to show people what we've been doing during the week. And it's not a show so much as it's a presentation to explain what we've been doing, which will probably be fun anyway, because we spend a lot of our time laughing together over these little improvs that happen, little games we play. So that'll be Saturday night, but I don't know. The tickets may be hard to get at this point. I'm not sure.
I think I saw that it's sold out.
Is it sold out?
Oh, looks like it.
Okay. Well,
okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call, Joyce.
Thank you.
Let's go to Bob in Jackson. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello, Bob.
First of all, Alan Alda, it is absolutely wonderful to speak with you, sir.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed your work. I've been really practicing looking at folks putting on their pants one leg at a time, but I am still in awe when I get to a famous person.
You
so
know,
thank you very much for the opportunity.
It's very interesting you say that. I have two friends who broke their legs putting their pants on.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that horrible? Especially as men get older, it's more and more dangerous to put your pants on. And I always thought it was taking them off that was the dangerous part. But they fall over when the second toe is looking for the pants leg. They just tip over.
My Lord.
I'm sorry. I know you didn't call to talk about that. What was your question?
Pardon me? Improv conversation and an example of exactly what you're talking about. So I've just been through a situation in my life, and I've had to regain my balance.
Oh, really?
Trying to lift one leg and not open it.
Oh, Bob,
your
hands.
I'm terribly sorry. You're breaking up a little.
Yeah, your cell phone connection is...
My landline, I got to move just a little bit here.
Oh.
I walk around when I talk.
Now you sound much better.
Well, thank you very much. But I used to be able to play the piano, but now I can't. The thing about that improv that you were talking about, your laugh in that series MASH, I mean, I've seen you in a number of other things, frankly, but, you know, I think you probably get it, too. So many people go back to MASH. When you would laugh, when those guys, and then you were just talking about an improv thing, and you were saying that you could read your line, and it would say in the script, all right, right there, you're supposed to laugh. But otherwise, you would get, you know, your feedback from the other folks. You would laugh. It didn't look like you were just laughing because it said laugh here. So were you practicing that kind of stuff back when you were in that series also?
In a version of what we were doing makes the answer yes. What we did was we became a group as the first step to improvisation, I think. What I was saying about getting together and accepting one another, getting to know one another, getting intimate with one another, is what we did. And we would sit around in a circle all day long and make each other laugh in between shots. You know, it sometimes takes an hour to light a shot. And so you have to wait. And often actors will go back to their dressing rooms and be alone. We would sit together most of the time and laugh. And when we got on camera, we had this warm feeling, this connection with one another, that we just kept going with the lines of the scene. And if laughing was part of it or being argumentative was part of it, it could erupt naturally between us because we already had a connection going. So that's where it came from.
Hmm. That goes back to your first lesson there, get to know your fellow actors.
Yeah, right.
I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking with Alan Alda, actor, writer, director, and this week he's the 2013 master teacher at Ten Chimneys. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234, and we'll get to more of them after this break. I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Alan Alda. He's the Ten Chimneys 2013 master teacher. We're talking about the importance of spontaneity, not just on stage, but in everyday life and even in the sciences. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. If our phone lines are busy, why don't you try emailing us at talk@wpr.org or leave us a message on Facebook. Speaking of Facebook, Anna wrote to us there, and she wanted to know, she says, I enjoy watching Mr. Alda in all of his movies and in MASH. Acting seems to come natural to you. Where did you study?
This is very interesting. I know it's not considered formal study, but my father was an actor, and when I was born, he was acting in burlesque, and I would stand in the wings from the time I was old enough to stand. And I would watch my father perform, first in burlesque, then in nightclubs, and then in movies, and then in vaudeville, and then on Broadway. And all through my early years, I'd be standing in the wings watching him and the other actors. And I think that's a terrific way to learn, because you're just a foot or two away from them, but you're in the dark in a safe place. But you see how they create the illusion, and it's you see it from a different angle than what you see when you're in the audience. Mm. The only way I really trained was in improvisation. When I had been in a couple of improv companies, and I took regular classes for about 6 months. Working on this kind of improvising called theater games, and it really changed my life. And you know, when you talk about the value of improv, not only on the stage but in life, it really, in a way, enabled me to be a more outgoing person and be more comfortable with people I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you observed others, how did you decide what strengths to try to incorporate into your own practice?
Strength with regard to what? I'm sorry, I don't get
I don't know. I guess as you watched other people act, and resonated with you that you thought, I need to incorporate that when I go on stage?
Oh, I see. Yeah. As I was observing people.
Yes.
I see. I think I got it. It's interesting. My father was a very handsome leading man. And when I began, it wasn't that I incorporated what I was seeing. I thought it was important for me to be different from what he did. And I became an eccentric comic actor. And so I wouldn't be in competition with him, because he was so handsome and so so attractive on the stage that I couldn't compete with that. So I could compete if I was funny. So I started out that way. And then I reached a certain age where I was getting certain parts where I had to be the leading man, and I had to take on that responsibility. And that was a kind of growth for me. It was very interesting.
Hmm. Well, a listener named Dave wrote to us. He says that he really enjoys you hosting the PBS program, Scientific American Frontiers.
Oh, that's very nice. Thank you.
He wants to, well, you talked a little bit about Brains on Trial. He's wondering if you're doing anything more along the lines of PBS programming, but also wondering how you view today's teaching on science in public schools. Do you have any recommendations on how we might improve educating our kids?
Well, I think in all education of science, it's a really good idea for the person teaching it to know who they're talking to. It's like a basic element. For instance, in improvising, I don't mean to hit that nail on the head until it goes through the board and comes out the other side. But the basic thing is that you're in it with the other person, and you have to make contact with the other person. And just as on Scientific American Frontiers, where I got them to talk directly to me and tell me personally what there was about their work I should know, and not make a lecture to the camera. The tone changed when that happened, and I was able to understand them. And I think any time difficult material is being explained to students or to any audience, you have to know who you're talking to, and you have to know where they are in their understanding at the moment, and you have to be in contact with them. And one of the things that we're doing at the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook is taking student teachers and training them in communication. You know, there's this system where a graduate student will be assigned to teach undergraduates simply because he or she knows the material, but they don't necessarily know, they haven't had any training in communication or in educational theory or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we train them in communication, and the teaching goes much better. The students are more able to understand what they're talking about because they're making contact with them better.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Jim in Wauwatosa. Hi, Jim.
Oh, I got to take a deep breath here because you're talking about one of my idols.
Hello, Jim.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
Hi, you're good. Thank you.
Listen, I wanted to ask you about word plays and how you sort of structure them and how you kind of study them. You know, MASH changed my life, and part of it was the word plays, but there's one episode, you know, where you can't stop sneezing.
Yeah.
And somebody, you're in the office with Harry Morgan, and somebody says, you know, there's complaining about you, and you said, would you all please just, you know, keep your business out of my nose? And you sort of reverse two words, and I just want to know, do you actually study word plays?
Well, that... I do enjoy wordplay, and that show I can't remember if that show was written by Larry Gelbart. I didn't write that show. I know somebody else wrote it. That was a sort of a landmark show for me because on that show there was a moment where I had to start a scene being cocky and making jokes, and by the end of the scene I was supposed to be sobbing. In tears, and I had never had that job to do before. I mean, if I had to cry, I had a chance to start the scene crying, and I could sort of get ready for it. But to come from laughing to crying without a break was an interesting task that I had never had before, and I'd stayed up the night before on the set till like 12 or 1 in the morning, trying to figure out what would trigger it in me, and I finally did it, and it was a very nice moment in my acting life where I climbed another step up the ladder in what I was able to accomplish. I'm not sure I ever accomplished it again after that, come to think of it, but it was a good thing to accomplish that time. But I'll tell you about wordplay. What interests me about wordplay, puns are universally considered bad things. And in fact, I have a friend who will not laugh at a pun. He's incapable of it. Even a good pun, he'll go, ooh, like somebody has just passed gas, you know. But that's not a really good pun. There are classic puns where you take a well-known, maybe a cliched phrase, and put a twist on it so that it's not just that the words mean something else, but it actually has meaning in and of itself. Now, you're going to ask for an example, and I can't think of one, but listen to puns, and sometimes they actually mean something. And those are classic puns and well worth the listening to, I think. But just to say words, to put words together that sound like something else is boring unless it has some meaning.
Let's take one last call from Brian in Madison. Hi, Brian.
Hi. They told me to be quick, but I watched you welcome BJ on a rerun to the unit last night. Now I'm talking to you. Pretty surreal. See, I have a question.
Yeah.
I have a 17-year-old daughter, and she does a variety of kind of acting. And just I'd love your advice for her in sort of the improvisational realm as she finishes up high school and looks to the future. What guidance would you give to her?
Well, I think it would really benefit her if she could learn improvisation from somebody who can work with her using Viola Spolin's theater games. That's very valuable. Secondly, I think it's really important to have to have something you can do to earn a living while you're not getting work as an actor, because 98% of actors don't make a living at it. And thirdly, it's very important to find a life partner who shares your values, presuming you have some values, but to be able to stick with your values through your life. There are a lot of pressures on you that without the help of a partner who knows what your values are, it's very easy to wind up at the end having made a lot of wrong choices that you're not really that happy with.
Well, Alan Alda, we only have about 30 seconds left, and I'm wondering if people are on the lookout for your next piece of work. You're talking about Brains on Trial. Where can we find that this fall?
That'll be on PBS in September. I can't remember the dates, but sometime in September, 2 one-hour shows about the effect that the new brain science will have on the justice system, and it's a fascinating subject, and it's happening. We're learning more about the brain, and it's beginning to affect the justice system, and therefore will affect all of us.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Our guest has been Alan Alda, accomplished actor on TV, stage, and film, and he's the host of a couple of PBS programs, as we just heard. And this week, he's the 2013 master teacher at Ten Chimneys Theater in Genesee Depot. I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is the Ideas Network.